The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I want to begin to acknowledge that all of you came on your day off, the 4th of July. You could be in a park having a barbecue and waiting for the fireworks, but here you are. So I wish for you that the quiet joy that comes from investigating the Dharma illuminates your inner world, as opposed to the loud and flashy, fast fireworks that just last a few seconds and then the pleasure is gone. So tonight I want to speak about the 6 contemplations of the body. These contemplations are part of the 4 foundations of mindfulness. They're part of the first one, which is dedicated to the body. When we meditate, we learn that we can focus our attention on many different focuses. But some give you wisdom and some don't. We can focus on an object and it might give us concentration, but it won't give us wisdom. So the Buddha gives us these focuses so that we not only get to quiet and concentration, but also wisdom. And so the body is an essential part of these focuses. I would say the most important. And within this first foundation, he gives us 6 different contemplations. The way that I want to go through these 6 contemplations is not so much as your usual Dharma talk where somebody speaks, you listen rationally. I want very much that at the end of the talk you have a felt sense of each of the contemplations. So you're welcome to close your eyes, or if you don't want to close your eyes, that's fine, but hopefully you listen to it with your body. And I will speak in a different way, you know, not as a narrative, but I would pose questions, leave some space in between to allow you to touch in, feel in. So the first contemplation is the breath. You've all heard about paying attention to the breath so many times. But I want us to really consider the question, why is it difficult? Why is it difficult to pay attention to the breath? From the moment we're born till we die, the breath is with us. And perhaps because it's with us all the time, we take it for granted and we don't pay attention. It suggests to me like the water for the fish. It's difficult for the fish to see the water. Also, I think it requires from us to sharpen our ability to perceive subtlety. Mind has to quiet to really perceive subtlety. But also mind quiets from observing the breath. So it works as a circle. Now for many people, when you tell them, pay attention to the breath, what happens is that the breath becomes constricted. It certainly happened to me a lot at the beginning. So what suggests to me the breath is like a small, shy child. So when we have the situation that the breath constricts when we pay attention, we want to fine-tune that attention for it to be softer Or we also want to put the attention perhaps not quite at the breath at the beginning, but maybe in another part of the body where we feel grounded. The next question that I want to pose is, why pay attention to the breath? It's very practical because it's always there. We don't have to go get anything. It's with us all the time, as I mentioned before. It also is a wonderful anchor. If you envision a ship without an anchor, it just gets pushed, whatever the tide is doing. But once you have an anchor, the ship will stay in one place, and that's where what our minds need. The breath is also a powerful reminder of impermanence. If we truly pay attention to the breath, we notice how it's constantly changing. I don't know if you've ever considered that looking at the breath during meditation is interesting because it gives you this juxtaposition between the stillness of the body and yet movement too, because when you're breathing, there is movement, even though it's very subtle. The breath will also and give us a lot of information about our physical state and our emotional state. I also want us to consider intimacy. When we think of intimacy, I think most of us think of intimacy in relation to somebody else. But what I find very beautiful about working with the breath is that it offers intimacy with ourselves. To the degree that this intimacy with ourselves grows, we connect deeper with other people. I have had times when the breath feels so soft and gentle that it's like an inner caress. So let that be enough of the first contemplation, the breath. Take a few moments to just feel in with your breath and see how it is right now. The second contemplation is posture. So much is communicated with the posture of our body to ourselves, to our mind, and to other people. How we hold ourselves during meditation can foster alertness. Notice also that when we're meditating, if we make small adjustments, very precise small adjustments, our concentration increases right away. This posture that we hold during meditation communicates to ourselves and others stability and dignity. I have even explored posture when falling asleep. So if anybody has find themselves having trouble falling asleep, I really recommend check your posture. You will find that your posture is such that you are locking energy in certain parts of the body and therefore there's tension. And if you can just put your awareness in that part of the body and allow the body to soften and for the energy to flow, combined with the breath, you will most likely go to sleep. I recently attended a talk on people who have problems with sleep. This was at a senior center, and I was struck how prompt the speaker would recommend medication right away for every single problem that she talked about sleep. The immediate segue was medication. So can we be more proactive and explore other possibilities rather than this very passive response of swallowing a pill? Let's take a moment. This is the end of the what I want to communicate to you of the second contemplation of posture. Take a moment to tune in. What is your posture like now? What happens if you make very precise, small adjustment? The third contemplation is bodily activities. Whatever we do during our day, we bring the mindfulness to that bodily activity, be it brushing our teeth, cooking, bathing. So let us take a moment and imagine, bring to mind one activity that we do every day. And hopefully with this soft, quiet body and mind that you have now, can you envision yourself going through that activity with that soft mind and body? The fourth contemplation is the anatomical parts of the body. So here we're contemplating the body with its different components. So not as a whole, but we're looking at components such as skin, flesh, and bones. So why do we deconstruct our body into its discrete parts? The main reason, and I think the most difficult one to internalize, is that the body, within this whole body, There is no self, there is not me. If we look at a very simple example, think of a splendid new Porsche. Now we're going to put apart the Porsche in all its various parts. Once we have deconstructed the whole car, do we still have a Porsche? The idea also to deconstruct the body in several parts is to gain some distance from this body that we are so enchanted with. We can think the enchantment that comes when we are in love with somebody. And this practice can help us when this enchantment, when this attraction would not be a skillful activity for us, would not be something we want to follow, because it would create harm either for us or for somebody else. So this practice would definitely help us to break the enchantment. It might also help to know that originally this practice was conceived for celibacy for monks and nuns. And this is not the case for us, and yet it can definitely be very useful at times. It can also be very useful as far as the over-preoccupation that we have about our looks. Take just for example the skin. And take a moment to envision the skin in your body from the head all the way down to the feet. And be aware what aspects of the skin have caused you concern, embarrassment, pain, for whatever reason, because it has blemishes. So we devote so much attention to the appearance of this body, but not so much a felt sense of the body from the inside out. Now the fifth contemplation. This is about the four elements. We look at our body according to the four elements of the earth, water, fire, and wind. We're focusing in particular about the commonalities of the characteristics of each element. Take earth. This is the solidity in our body, such as the teeth, the skull, and the bones. Now take water, the characteristics of liquid. So we're looking at the liquids in our body, such as tears, sweat, blood. and the fire, as the different temperatures in our body. Be aware right now how in different parts of your body you have different temperatures. And finally, the wind. The characteristic is the movement. The different movements in our body, particularly like the breath. I also like to think of these four elements as a reminder of where we originate and where we go back to. We could also look at it as a reminder of our connection with nature. I am convinced if there is mindfulness in the body, we will not harm our environment. Now we come to the last contemplation, in the sixth. This is the death contemplation. Death contemplation is the most powerful practice to internalize impermanence. In this body that we call me is just borrowed for a time, and we will have to give it up sometime. It's interesting to consider that the Pali term rupa, that means matter, is connected with another term that means decay. And that means all matter decays. So not only we are not owners of our body, but we also do not have control of this body decaying, aging. I want to read you a couple of strophes from Ambapali, a Buddhist philosopher from ancient India around 500 BC. She followed the Buddha and became an arahant. So, for example, as far as the hair, it says, thick and lush, like a well-tended grove, made splendid, the tips elaborate with comb and pin. With age, it grew thin and bare, here and there. The truth of the truth, speaker's words, doesn't change. Radiant, brilliant, like jewels, my eyes. With age, they're no longer splendid. The truth of the truth, speaker's words, doesn't change. So we have these heavenly messengers in Buddhism that we talk about. The Buddha's father tried to protect his son from these messengers, illness, aging, and death. But in the end, he was unable to do so. We would all like to be shielded from personal loss, And now I come to a point where I need to communicate a loss that we just had today. Today at noon, we lost a very, very dear friend and Sangha member, Victor Medina, died today. Victor was a computer engineer and a musician. He was a flutist, like me. As I found out the news of Victor's death today, I had to change the talk. I couldn't go ahead and give the talk I had planned. So, what I'd like to do is to read to you an excerpt from a novel called Momo by Michael Ende. Michael Ende is a German novelist. This novel called Momo was written for children, and yet it has great wisdom, depth, and beauty. I trust that by the end of this excerpt that I read to you, you will be able to pull together all the threads that I have presented to you with the contemplations of the body. First, I'll give you just two short paragraphs to introduce the novel. We first meet Momo in the ruins of an amphitheater in an indistinct time and place in modern Italy. She's a homeless street child of gypsy-like appearance who does not even know her own age. Having escaped from an institution, she is adopted by the poor family living nearby, who soon find themselves visiting her often. Momo has a wonderfully calming influence and the marvelous gift of truly listening to others. For instance, she helps two old friends, Salvatore and Nino, end a long feud, and even gets a silent canary to start singing again. She knows the value of each individual soul, so that even if someone felt that his life had been an utter failure, after speaking to her, he realizes that there was only one person like himself in the whole world. This excerpt that I'm going to read to you takes place in the magical residence of Professor Secundus Minutus Hora, who lives in Nowhere House in Never Lane, where all the time in the world comes from. He is the custodian of time, but has no personal power to stop the time thieves. So this is just as far as the introduction. So, for Victor. Tell me, Momo says, what exactly is time? I mean, time itself. It exists. So it must be something. What is it really? The professor smiled. It would be nice if you worked out your own answer to that question too. Momo pondered for a long time. It exists, she mused. That much I do know, but you can't touch or hold it. Could it be something like a perfume? Then again, it's always passing by, so it must come from somewhere. Perhaps it's like the wind. No, wait. Perhaps it's a kind of music you just don't hear because it's always there. She paused, then added, though I have heard it sometimes, I think, very faintly. The professor nodded. I know. That's why I was able to summon you here. But there must be more to it than that, said Momo, still pursuing her train of thought. The music comes from far off, but I seem to hear it deep inside me. Perhaps time works that way too. She broke off, bewildered. I mean, she said, like the wind making the waves in the sea. She shrugged and shook her head. I expect I'm talking nonsense. Not at all, said the professor. I think you put it very prettily indeed. That's why I'm going to let you into a secret. If you want to know, all the time in the world comes from here, from Nowhere House, Never Lane. Momo gazed at him in awe. I see, she said softly. You mean you make it yourself? The professor smiled again. No, my child, I'm merely its custodian. All human beings have their allotted span of time. My task is to see that it reaches them. In that case, said Momo, why not simply arrange things so they don't have any more of it stolen by the time thieves? I can't, the professor told her. What people do with their time is their own business. They must guard it themselves. I can only distribute it. Momo looked around the great hall. Is that why you keep all these clocks? One for every person in the world? No, Momo, these clocks are just a hobby of mine. They are a very imperfect copies of something that everyone carries inside him. Just as people have eyes to see light and ears to hear sounds with, so they have hearts for the appreciation of time. And all the time they fail to appreciate is as wasted on them as the colors of the rainbow are wasted on a blind person or the nightingale's song on a deaf one. Some hearts are unappreciative of time. I fear, though they beat like the rest of us. What will happen when my heart stops beating? Momo asked. When that moment comes, said the professor, time will stop for you as well. Or rather, you will retrace your steps through time, through all the days and nights, months and years of your life, until you go out through the gate, round silver gate you entered by. What will I find on the other side? The home of the music you've sometimes faintly heard in the distance. But by then you'll be part of it. You yourself will be a note in its mighty harmonies. Professor Hora looked at Momo searchingly. But I don't suppose that makes much sense to you, does it? Yes, said Momo, I think so. Then recalling her strange progress along Never Lane and the way she lived through everything in reverse, she asked, are you deaf? The professor smiled. If people knew the nature of death, he said after a moment's silence, they'd cease to be afraid of it. And if they cease to be afraid of it, no one could rob them of their time anymore. Why not tell them then, Momo suggested. I already do, said the professor. I tell the meaning of death with every hour I send them. But they refuse to listen. They'd sooner heed those who frighten them. That's another riddle in itself. I'm not frightened, said Momo. Professor Hora nodded slowly. He gave her another searching stare. Then he said, would you like to see where the time comes from? Yes, she whispered. I'll take you there, said the professor, but only if you promise not to talk or ask questions. Is that understood? Momo nodded. Professor Hora stooped and picked her up. All at once, he seemed immensely tall and inexpressibly old, but not as a man grows old, more in the manner of an ancient tree. Clasping Momo with one arm, he covered her eyes with his other hand so gently that it felt as if snowflakes were landing on her cheeks, like icy thistle down. Momo sensed that he was striding down a long, dark tunnel, but she felt quite safe and utterly unafraid. At first she thought she could hear her own heartbeats, but then she became more and more convinced that they were really the echoes of the professor's footsteps. After what seemed a very long way, he put Momo down. His face was close to hers when he removed his hand from her eyes. He gave her a meaningful look and put a finger to his lips. Then he straightened up and stepped back. Everything was bathed in a sort of golden twilight. When her eyes became accustomed to it, Momo saw that she was standing beneath a mighty dome as big as the vault of heaven itself, or so it seemed to her, and that the whole of this dome was made of the purest gold. High overhead, in the very center of the dome, was a circular opening through which a shaft of light fell straight onto an equally circular lake whose dark, smooth waters resembled a jet-black mirror. Just above the surface, glittering in the shaft of light with the brilliance of a star, something was slowly and majestically moving back and forth. Momo saw that it was a gigantic pendulum, but one with no visible means of support. Apparently weightless, it soared and swooped above the mirror's smooth water with bird-like ease. As the glittering pendulum slowly neared the edge of the lake, an enormous water lily bud emerged from its dark depths. The closer the pendulum came, the wider it opened, until at last it lay full-blown on the surface. Momo had never seen so exquisite a flower. It was composed of all the colors in the spectrum, brilliant colors such as Momo had never dreamed of. While the pendulum hovered above it, she became so absorbed in the spectacle that she forgot everything else. The scent alone seemed something she had always craved without knowing what it was. But then, very slowly, the pendulum swung back, and as it did so, Momo saw, to her dismay, that the glorious flower was beginning to wilt. Petal after petal dropped off and sank into the blackness below. To Momo, it was as if something unutterably dear to her was vanishing. By the time the pendulum reached the center of the lake, the flower had completely disintegrated. At that moment, however, a new bud arose near the opposite shore, and as the pendulum drew nearer, Momo saw that an even lovelier blossom was beginning to unfold. She walked around the lake to inspect it more closely. This new flower was altogether different from its predecessor. Momo had never seen such colors before, but these colors seemed richer and more exquisite by far. The petals, too, gave off a different and far more delicious scent, and the longer Momo studied them, the more marvelous in every detail she found them. But again the glittering pendulum swung back, and as it did so, the glorious blossom withered and sank, petal by petal, into the dark and unfathomable depths of the lake. Slowly, very slowly, the pendulum proceeded on its way, but not exactly to the same place as before. This time, it checked its swing a little way further along the shore, and there, one pace from where it had previously paused, another bud arose and unfolded. To Momo, this seemed the loveliest lily of all, the flower of flowers, a positive miracle. She could have wept aloud when this perfect blossom, too, began to fade and subside into the depths. But she remembered her promise to Professor Hora, and uttered no sound. Meanwhile, the pendulum had returned to the opposite shore, another pace further along, and a fresh bud broke the glassy surface. As time went by, it dawned on Momo that each new blossom differed entirely from those that had gone before, and that it always seemed the most beautiful of all. She wandered around the lake watching flower after flower unfold and die. Although she felt she would never tire of this spectacle, she gradually became aware of another marvel that had escaped her until now. She could not only see the shaft of light that streamed down from the center of the dome, she could hear it as well. At first, it reminded her of wind whistling in distant treetops, but the sound swelled until it resembled the roar of a waterfall or the thunder of waves breaking on a rocky shore. More and more clearly, Momo perceived that this mighty sound consisted of innumerable notes whose constant changes of pitch were forever weaving different harmonies. It was music, yet it was also something else. All at once she recognized it as the faraway music she had sometimes faintly heard while listening to the silence of a starry night. But now, as the sound became ever clearer and more glorious, she sensed that it was the resonant shaft of light that summoned each bud from the dark depths to the lake of the lake and fashioned it into a flower of unique and inimitable beauty. The longer she listened, the more clearly she could make out individual voices. Not human voices, but notes such as might have been given forth by gold and silver and every other precious metal in existence. And then, beyond them, as it were, voices of quite another kind made themselves heard, infinitely remote yet indescribably powerful. As they gained strength, Momo began to distinguish words uttered in a language she had never heard before, but could nonetheless understand. The sun and moon and planets and stars were telling her their own true names, and their names signified what they did and how they all combined to make each hour lily flower and fade in turn. Suddenly, Momo realized that all these words were directed at her. From where she stood to the most distant star in space, the entire universe was focused upon her like a single face of unimaginable size, looking at her and talking to her. What overcame her then was something more than fear. A moment later, she caught sight of Professor Horror, silently beckoning to her. She ran to him and buried her face in his chest. Taking her in his arms, he put one hand over her eyes as before, light as thistledown, and carried her back along the endless tunnel. Again, all seemed dark. But again, she felt snug and secure. Once they were back in the little clock-lined room, he laid her down on the sofa. "Professor Hora," Momo whispered, "I never knew that everyone's time was so..." She strove to find the right word, but in vain. "So big," she said eventually. "What you've just seen and heard wasn't everyone's time," the professor replied. "It was only your own. There's a place like the one you visited in every living soul, but only those who let me take them there can reach it, nor can it be seen with ordinary eyes." So where was I? In the depths of your own heart. So perhaps it can take just a couple of seconds or a minute to take in the reading and the contemplations of the body. So we just have a couple minutes left. So if anybody would like to comment, ask a question. And it's okay too if we want to leave it in silence. So welcome. So may each one of you find your own time in your heart. Good night.